General Cooper, Reel 2. Did you have any hitches in the training at all?
Well, there are always hitches, especially in a new arm or corps. You see, one has got to remember it. All these aids to training, your ranges, your running targets, your miniature ranges, which of course have got running targets across, they were practically all built by the instructors on the spot. And they didn't have all that amount of money, so of course they had to make things in the workshops themselves. And as you know, do-it-yourself is never as good as a well-designed, tested. There was no time to test the things. They were tested on you. So they broke down, and of course they were learning to improve it. And so they were changing their bearing aids. Then, of course, the vehicles, when you were out on the ranges or even out on your driving and maintenance. You get a lot of different people on a tank. As I mentioned before, the tank is the machine is a very individual thing, but you get different lot of people driving it. The wear and tear on the machine is far greater, and of course they do break down. And so you quite often missed out, where you should have had 2 hours driving instruction. Perhaps you were unlucky and you got 1 hour's driving instruction. Mm. And things like that. Mm. Or, on the other hand, of course, if it did break down while you were out in the field, you plus the instructor had to get down and mend it. So you learned perhaps, though you lost your driving, you probably learned a lot more about the actual maintenance and the mending of the vehicle.
What were the workshop facilities like at that time for maintenance and repair?
Well, they were very small. And, of course, all run by the Royal Tank Regiment Corps. They were the fittest staff, and a jolly hard-working lot of chaps they were, too.
Were the workshop facilities mobile, so that if you broke down in some way away from base, you could be repaired in the field?
Only minor repairs. You didn't have the fitter's lorries that you have today. They were purely 1500 weight with a fitter in it, and he probably had a few spares, easy spares, and some spanners, but no machinery at all. They couldn't do any big repairs, and certainly no. A winch or crane to lift any of the heavier pieces out. You couldn't do any major repairs, but minor repairs.
Mm. Well, what would happen then if you broke down somewhere away from base and it was a major breakdown which couldn't be repaired by what the spares that the fitters could bring out? How would you deal with that?
Well,
problem?
Then, of course, it was a business for the staff to send out, the headquarters to send out another tank to tow it in. And go into the workshops where it'd be properly repaired.
I see. Going back to the gunnery training, was there any static gunnery in the course? Or was it, you've described the decreasing range.
Oh, training. Well, the static, of course, you started off your firing. I mean, the first time that you fired your gun was static at a range, might have been 800 yards, but that doesn't matter, because you had to get used to the fact that when you fired, there's the flash, and of course some people are nervous and some people are not, so it had been a waste of ammunition to put them straight onto a running or firing on the move on the running target. So it was a static one at a static target. You had a few rounds of that merely to get you accustomed to estimating the range, using the sights, and this flash, which cuts right across the telescope, and might upset you. You get used to it, but after that, after you've done two or three rounds, you don't hardly notice it. Mm.
Did machine guns figure in the gunnery training?
Oh, very much so, yes.
Tell me how they did that side of things, what the exercises were there.
Well, again, with your machine guns, you started off on ground mountings, just like the ordinary infantry, because they were infantry Vickers machine guns. You started on that, and you fired on that, got used to them. You, of course, learned how to strip them down. And your final thing was to strip it down blindfold. That was the final thing. Because in a tank, it's dark. You don't have a lot of light. And you've got to get used to the mounting. It's a ball mounting. And so they had outside on the range, you went from the fixed mounting to the ball mounting. But the ball mounting wasn't inside the tank, it was just fixed up on a tripod on the range. And you got used to maneuvering your mounting. And then from that you went inside the tank. For a big person, I myself found it a little difficult because your firing position is, you've got to sit on your backside and tuck your feet underneath you in order to get your head down to the telescope. Of course you've got nothing to strap yourself, and so you've got, when you're on the move, you've also got to balance yourself. It takes quite a considerable lot of practice.
How did you do it?
Well, there was a way of sitting like this. I can't do it because my leg, and you held it like that with both hands. It's exactly the same as an infantry one, but of course you've got the movement of the tank and you've got the ball mounting, and you've got to try and keep that gun on the target. You didn't have a telescope, you had a backsight and a foresight. But of course one's got to remember with with a machine gun, it's more spraying the target rather than direct shooting.
So you'd be bracing yourself while you were firing the machine gun?
Well, you can only brace yourself by putting your... You had nothing for your back. And you sort of caught hold of the gun, the Vickers gun, and you pulled that towards you, and your feet were up against the side of the tank. So that you had to do it that way.
What about the other members of the crew? Did they have any kind of similar problems to the ones you've just explained that the gunner had?
Your main armament gunner, he, of course, he stood up. And he could lean and had a rest which fitted his shoulder against the gun. And so that's a stability. And then he'd got his two hands. One was on the rotating wheel, and which rotated the turret. And the other was, of course, on the elevating and firing wheel. And so his hands were gripping something. And though they were movable, he could brace himself quite. But it was still a physical effort, and you've got to get used to it. And you did get used to it, and you rode it. I don't suppose it's much. In a way, you could say that if you were standing up, you rode it like a horse on your balancing, and your knees gave or didn't give, etc., etc. But you got some nasty jolts if you went down a ditch or anything, and you quite often go hurt. But nothing serious.
Was it possible to Well, did the inside of the tank, or was it constructed in a way that made allowances for against possible physical injury?
Oh, no. No, it was the inside of the tank was purely functional.
You had to take your chances.
You had to take your chances. But it's amazing how, with experience, you knew if there was trouble, what to catch hold of. And, of course, you're not always looking out the same way, but perhaps your commander, who's got an all-round, could suddenly shout out and give you warning that it was going to be a nasty jolt or a big switch. And Richard helped you a bit, but you did develop a knack of putting your hand out in the right spot and not on a jagged edge of the vehicle.
If the commander shouted out, how would you hear him?
Oh, well, you had the intercommunication. You had your earphones. And he had a microphone and shouted at you, or kicked you in the backside. He could reach you.
There was actually internal wireless in the machines as early as this, was there?
Oh, yes, I'm sure there were.
I thought they had voice tubes and things like that, sort of pre-wireless arrangements.
Well, you know, you've got me now.
Well, not to worry. Look, let's
it
leave...
It probably was a voice tube down to the driver. I remember a voice tube to the driver. And perhaps in my young day, when I was a second lieutenant, perhaps it was only voice, and I'm forgetting. I think you may be right.
We've talked quite a lot about personal training. What about unit training? What kind of exercises were you practicing with the battalion during the course of the training year? What were the sort of emphasis of the training at this period?
Well, the first thing of collective training is that you start off with your section and you learn section drill in the same way that your infantryman learns foot drill. You learn tank drill. The varying formations, arrowhead formation, line ahead, line, and you learnt that, and you had to do that. You had little flags. Your section commander had a little flag, and he put up a flag, which was answered by the other tanks in the section, because you always had to answer it because of the distance it might be, so that the other tank may not have seen the commander, but if he saw one of the other tanks putting up, he knew he had to. And you spent quite a lot of time on this formation drill. You did that as a section, and then also in your section training or drill, you also learned the value of ground, the appreciation of the ground, where good held down positions, etc. Then you went from section training to company training. And again, you had company drill, where the company commander gave the put up the flag, and then the section commander took it up, and then it passed down to the individual tanks. And then the next period would be the battalion training, where you went out as a battalion, 50-odd tanks, and you drilled. You had your drill, battalion drill formations.
Once you got up to battalion scale training, this rather primitive means of communication with flags must have been rather difficult to...
It was difficult, it took time. Mm. It only took that much longer to come down, and of course the battalion commander had to allow for that, because you were moving all the time. But if he wanted, say, a mile ahead to be in a certain formation, then he'd have to start sometime before maneuvering his battalion to get in so that when he reached a certain spot, he was in the fighting formation he wanted.
Mm. As a preface to these exercises, was there much theory brought into the training so as to give a military purpose to the individual exercise you were doing?
That came afterwards. Your first thing was, of course, you did all these drills on a sand table as a drill. Flat bit of country, and you learnt it. In fact, you really did it on your flat feet to begin with. You had your tank crews, and you did not for very long on your flat feet, so you got it in your mind what the varying formations were. And that saved money. And then you did it in the actual tanks. You did your drill formations, and when they were satisfied that you could respond promptly and accurately with that, then you learnt on the sand table that the strict formation isn't quite the same, the tactical formation, though in essence it's the same. Of course, the ground must dictate the actual positions you're in. You can't have firm lines or anything like that. It's got to depend upon the ground. And so you learnt certain amount of that, theoretically, on the sand table. And then, of course, it was put into practice on the ground. And you, before you went on the ground, you'd have your company commander or section commander would say, well, now we're going to attack this, and this is how we're going to do it, because the enemy are there, and then you get into your tanks and do it. And then at the end of it, at the finish of it, after you completed that phase, then you'd all get together, and the leader, whether he was a section leader or the company leader or the battalion leader, he'd then get you round and point out where you went wrong and why, and then you went back to that and probably had to do it again if you didn't.
Were you involved in the in the exercises in 1927 of the experimental mechanized force?
In a very minor way.
Must have been quite an exciting experience. What do you remember about it?
Not an awful lot, because it was, when it gets down to a section, you know, it's very much the same. I mean, that was for the higher-ups.
Yes.
They were the experimental boys who were knowing what they were trying to experiment and something, but when you get right down to a section of just a solitary three or five tanks, you don't really get into this business of experiment. Because experimental really meant not in your... There wasn't so much experiment in the section drills or the section training. It was in the application of the brigade vis-a-vis other arms or on their own, and how they formed it against a theoretical enemy and that sort of thing. That's where the real...
Was there no attempt at the time to communicate to the junior officers and other ranks the way in which this particular training season was different from others which they had been through?
Well, of course, you did have, you always had your big after the exercises, the experimental exercises, and the staff had worked out this and that, there was then, of course, always an enormous conference, and you were told what went wrong, what were the advantages, what were the disadvantages. But I'm not sure, as a second lieutenant, you paid very much attention to it in the back rank of 200 or 300 officers in a big hall.
So this very historic training period, as far as the Corps was concerned, for junior officers and other ranks, was just like any other training exercise, was it?
Very much, very much.
Yes. In the debriefing...
We were very interested, of course, in the fact as to whether the the high-ups felt that this was a successful manoeuvres or a successful exercise for war. And that, of course, always cheered us up.
Do you remember what the conclusions were as regards this particular exercise?
No.
Okay,
no.
Fine. Do any of the training exercises and the part you played as a section officer between the years 1927 and 1930 stand out? Were there any that for you were particularly eventful?
Oh, I think one which was amusing was we finished up just outside Tidworth with a dawn attack, and we swept through the lines of a cavalry regiment whilst they were sitting down at tables having their breakfast. Much to their surprise.
This must have made you feel quite good.
And this, of course, gave us plenty of scope afterwards for pulling their legs and saying, well, a lot of bows and arrows, or old-fashioned soldiers they were.
Yes.
Did you... We went through the whole horse lines.
Mm-hmm. What sort of relationship did you have with cavalry officers at a personal level?
Oh, a very good relationship in games. Socially, we were not too close, except in individual cases, where one might happen to know them from a family point of view, not anything to do with the army. Because, of course, one must appreciate, as I say, we were a poor regiment. The cavalry were rich regiments. And they, of course, played more polo than ordinary games like rugby. Though they did play rugby and they did play cricket, but not to the same extent. And so, of course, you didn't mix socially to any great extent in that respect with the cavalry. Perhaps more with the gunners. You did?
Did this social thing, fact that the RTC was a new arm and a relatively poor one, did this induce any sort of mild inferiority complexes on the part of the young officers like yourself, as compared with the other arms?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that, as a matter of fact, I suppose, in a way, if you were a cynic, you could say it was because we had an inferiority complex. We developed a superiority complex in that we reckoned we were streets ahead of them in the military field. But I don't know that that really is true. I think it was only a cynic who would say that. But because we did feel that we were superior to them. In fact, we knew we were, because we were the modern cavalry arm.
Mm-hmm. There was a very...
And that was a very definite feeling. And not to put into us, but you felt, yes, this is it. We are the modern cavalry, and that the cavalry would have to change their minds and get rid of their horses.
Okay, let's go on to the next
we
period.
We met them to a certain extent, because one must remember up to 19, I think it was 28 or 29. We all had a we had some charges on our strength for umpiring purposes, was the excuse. And so we did mix, we did, those of us who were interested in riding did have an opportunity to ride and go out hunting or coursing with the cavalry. Mm-hmm. But there were few, we mm-hmm. only had a few mm-hmm. horses. Mm-hmm. Then they abolished them for expense.
Yes. One of the features of this period between the wars, which Little Heart in particular makes great play on, is, he suggests, a very grave and strong sense of rivalry and almost hostility between the RTC and the cavalry, with the cavalry feeling threatened by the emergent new corps and reacting in a very reactionary kind of way. Does that sort of square with your experiences as a young officer?
I suppose in a way he's right, but I think he's thinking much more of the senior officers as opposed to the junior officers. But of course it always creeps down below, and I think with you'll always get in any society, you will get snobs, but I wouldn't say they were in the majority by any means in the cavalry regiments or vice versa. Mm. There were some in the cavalry, youngsters in the cavalry regiments who were utter snobs, and we couldn't, you didn't get on with them, but that was individuals, but not as a whole. I wouldn't have said there was that feeling. Mm.
Can you remember any examples of this when it did occur?
No, I don't.
Okay. Now, in 1930, you were sent to India, joined the 11th Armoured Car Company, RTC, and your first posting was to Delhi. What was the RTC establishment in Delhi at that time?
It was simply an armoured car company. We had, in various parts of India, there was an armoured car company. And they spent so many years in one station, and then the stations moved round because you had to relieve the armoured car companies who were up on the frontier, northwest frontier. As a young subaltern, or anybody then, any officer, you went out there on a 5-year tour to India for 5 years, and you were posted to one of these companies, and I was posted to 11 Company in the old fort, or the Red Fort of Old Delhi. And you had your armoured cars there, and of course you changed, your role changed then from, in England it was for a major war in Europe. Out there, of course, your main preoccupation was internal security.
Had you worked with armoured cars before?
Never.
Did you have any formal training once you got out there to learn to operate with them?
No, again, the same sort of pattern evolved out there as you had at home, your individual training season, your collective training season. And you had lectures on internal security, and you did a little bit of the other too, but that was the secondary role.
A little bit of the other?
Well, what should I say, major war. But of course for armoured cars it was, in India it was no, it was merely to support anything that might happen up in the frontier.
Did you find much of a contrast operating with an armoured car company after operating with a tank battalion?
Oh, well, I could say straight away your contrast. Apart from the internal security work, but for major war was with armored cars, of course, your vision and speed of movement was so much greater than it was with tanks because of your mobility and your radius of action. And you were much more out there on your own as a section leader, section commander out there of five armored cars. You were operating both from internal security and other points of view, far divorced from your company commander, and you were at home. So therefore you had to be much more, use much more of your own initiative.
What kind of armored cars were you working with?
Well, we started off, when I first got there, we had Crossleys. And then we started to be equipped shortly afterwards, partially, with the Crossley was a four-wheeled vehicle,